Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember European banks and the debt crisis and all of that jazz? Well, I am sorry to have to tell you, it seems like it is back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, July the 10th. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You will be forgiven if, after you hear what I'm about to tell you, you stop what you're doing, you look at your radio or your device of choice, and you say, wait, Portugal? Sadly, yes, Portugal. You remember the European debt crisis, right? Not dead yet, it seems. Worries over one Portuguese bank today very quickly became worries over Europe's broader financial health. Trading was suspended in one of Portugal's biggest banks, Banco Espírito Santo, after debt payments were missed, and we learned of some pre-existing concerns about its parent company. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
All it takes is one bank teetering to remind investors that Europe's troubled past is still very much a part of its present. Ken Hughes is with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.
Certainly, memories are still fresh about a very difficult situation in Europe. And all you have to do is get a couple people start to move and don't want to be left behind.
The European Central Bank is currently looking into the assets of its major financial institutions, like the stress tests we do here. So this triggered some worry about the results of those tests and whether the ECB would act if there were more problems like Banco Espírito Santo, says Robert Kahn with the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a wake-up call.
But it does remind us that European growth remains too slow. Their process of cleaning up their banks has a long way to go. And the policies the Europeans are doing are far from ideal from the U.S. perspective.
Because Europe is America's largest trading partner. Clay Lowry with Rock Creek Global Advisors says it's unlikely that today's scare will translate into tangible impacts in the U.S. But
if the European economy is not growing as well as, you know, one would hope, then that could harm the exports because people don't have as much money to buy things, companies don't have as much money to buy things, etc.
For the most part, the interdependency of American and European economies is a good thing, says Lowry. But in times of uncertainty, it can also make investors jumpy. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Another day, another data breach. Not so much consumers directly this time as the government of the United States. We learned today that back in March, Chinese hackers broke into the network that stores information about federal employees, looking apparently for people who applied for top secret security clearances. It's as yet unclear how much data they got, but if the government and big companies like, Target, can't protect the data that they have on us, who can? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Hackers mostly used to be bored teenagers or shut-in conspiracy theorist types. That's not the case anymore, says Larry Poneman, a data security specialist.
These are people that have two PhDs, quantum mechanics and physics, and they can pretty much get anywhere they want to if they put their minds to it.
Poneman says cyber criminals might be bankrolled by companies, drug cartels, or even governments, and they often work in teams.
This is the vault at the Bellagio.
That's from Ocean's 11, the movie where a team of criminals bands together to rob three casinos, which have state-of-the-art security.
I like that analogy.
Ted Julian is with CO3 Systems, which helps companies respond to data breaches.
The bad guys certainly think that way. And they will find talent. There's an underground market for it that's global. But I think there's an opportunity for the good guys to do that, too.
Julian says companies and government organizations need to assemble teams of their own to secure everything from financial transactions to email to mobile apps. And they'll have to keep investing, says Larry Poneman.
The problem is whatever solutions we create today, within a matter of months, they figure and then run around that technology.
In spite of organizations spending around $44 billion a year on cybersecurity, cybercrime costs consumers an estimated $110 billion a year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, much wailing and gnashing of teeth early on about Portugal and Europe. Traders did manage to fight most of the way back, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can talk big companies and Wall Street banks and macroeconomic indicators until you are blue in the face, and sometimes we do. But every now and then, you got to go where the action is, where the real economy happens, which we do every now and then by getting people on the phone. Today, it's Steve Presser. He owns Big Fun Toy Store out in Cleveland, Ohio. He's been on with us a couple of times over the past year or three. Steve, it's good to talk to you again.
Always good to talk to with you, Kai.
So we had you on, spring of last year, a little more than a year ago. You said business was picking up. Still the case? People still in Cleveland buying toys?
Well, they're still buying toys, but not at the level I would like them to have bought. Mother Nature was not nice to us over the winter. So, you know, when you have 0 degree temperature and you have a foot of snow, the wary traveler or the person who's looking to buy a collectible toy just doesn't venture down the street.
Are you experiencing then any pent-up demand from all those people who didn't go out in January and February? Are they coming in the nice weather and picking up whatever it is that they're going to pick up?
I would hope so, but June was not also nice to us in the sense that we had lots of rain. So July, August, and the rest of the year, this pent-up demand is hopefully going to pull us through the summer.
I'm sorry to laugh, but it seems like you can't win for losing.
That's the story of my life, Kai.
How's hiring for you? I mean, do you have enough business that you can get people on, even part-time, or are you laying people off? What are you doing?
Well, I've always been a superior optimist, and I try to avoid laying off. In fact, I don't think in the history of the 23 years I've been in business, I've laid off anybody. I've gone with an approach of spot hiring, obviously during seasonal, you know, holiday season, and summertime we're strong. So I've added a couple part-time positions, and I'm looking to develop more of a web presence so I'm able to pick up more hirees that way.
You're in Cleveland, Ohio, which has had its share of tough times. Do you see that region? Do you see Northeast Ohio coming back?
You know, things are really turning around here. I have younger children. They've moved back into the city. Their friends are moving back. You know, we've always had a strong medical environment. We're getting stronger in the technology industry. And, Cleveland, you know, they used the word comeback, but we really are getting stronger.
This is perhaps a question that is premature, but you have been in this business now, what, 24-something years, right?
Almost 24, yes.
At some point, you're going to not want to do it anymore. What are you going to do with the business? You're going to sell it? You're going to give it to your kids? You're going to shut her down?
That's a good question. That's a $64,000 question. Yeah. I thought about that. And, you know, I have friends who are in similar situations. My kids, you know, God love them, this is not a business they want to go in. And I've offered each of them, all three of them. But I love this business. In fact, I opened with one of my employees of 10 years, almost a little over a year ago. We opened up another location in Columbus, Ohio, where it's actually thriving. It's been doing wonderful. We have 1 year of baseline under us, but the sales just continue to improve.
So you're growing an empire then?
That's a relative term, empire. I like cities to begin with C, Cleveland Heights, Cleveland, and Columbus, and I guess Cincinnati, but I guess it's hard C's. Yeah. Hard C's for now.
Steve Presser, he owns Big Fun Toys in Cleveland, Ohio, and as we just learned, some other places as well. Mr. Presser, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
From the Labor Department, this item: there are as many job vacancies now as there were before the recession. That's got to be good news for out-of-work Americans, right? Yeah, maybe. Marketplace's David Gura explains why.
Since 2007, there has been this narrative that employers are not hiring or they're taking their time hiring because they can't find enough qualified candidates. Sylvia Allegretto is with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley.
The skills mismatch, you know, is kind of like the zombie explanation of the labor market that just won't go away.
It's true that during the downturn, employers could be choosy if they chose to hire at all. But the economy's gotten better. The unemployment rate's been coming down steadily. And Allegretto says that's not because all of a sudden people have all the right skills. Barry Hirsch is a professor of economics at Georgia State.
If we had severe mismatches throughout the labor market, we would be seeing more wage growth than we are seeing.
Qualified workers would be able to demand more money, and employers would have to meet that demand. Matt Friedman is a labor economist at Cornell, and he says there's a bigger reason why hiring is not happening faster.
Employers still have a lot of lingering uncertainty about the durability of this recovery.
they're cautious, and Friedman says there's really no reason for them to hurry.
There's very little cost to posting a vacancy, but potentially a lot of upside if you can find a really qualified person who's willing to work for you for very little money.
And for employers, that may be something worth waiting for. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace. Coming up.
A lot of people thought rollerblades, man, that must have started in Southern California. But in reality, it started in Minneapolis, Minnesota, hockey capital of the world.
Summertime brought to you by. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 70 points today, 0.4%, closed at 16,915. That's way better than the open, let me tell you that. The NASDAQ off 22 points, about 0.5%, 43.96. The S&P 500 lost 8 points, 0.4%, finished at 1964. OPEC came out with its first look at global oil demand next year. That is 2015. It said demand will be up after 4 years of decline in the world's wealthiest countries. Still, ExxonMobil finished the day down 1%. Chevron closed 0.8% lower. Costco finished up 0.1% after beating estimated sales. Family Dollar shaved 0.1% after its profits came in below estimates. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for June. The United Nations marks World Population Day with the theme Investing in Young People. And for those of you keeping track, our planet currently supports more than 7 billion of us. And on July 11th, 1960, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel To Kill a Mockingbird was first published. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just when you thought the lines at airport security could not possibly get any longer, nor planes more crowded, here comes Boeing to rain on your parade. They are out with some very rosy projections for the number of passengers expected to fly over the next 20 years. Rosy as in that number will double from today. Boeing says that's going to mean demand for nearly 37,000 new planes to accommodate everybody. $5.2 trillion in potential sales for them. Much, much more sharing the armrest with the person next to you for us. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
As incomes in developing countries go up, people take to the skies. Much of the increase in air travel over the next few years will be domestic flights within Asia on smaller single-aisle planes like Boeing 737.
When you have a smaller aircraft like that and shorter flights, you see an increase in the amount of emissions per head.
Mark Connold is with the World Watch Institute. He says according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change,
if things keep going the way they're going, emissions from the airline industry could double by 2020 and quadruple by 2050.
Aerospace engineer Magdi Atiya says it's difficult to predict the exact amount of fuel that a 737 burns on each trip.
A good estimate for the fuel burn is between 1,000 and 2,000 gallons per hour at cruise.
Atiya says new advances in engine technology could increase fuel efficiency by 12 to 15%. That would mean substantial savings for airlines. Fuel makes up about half their expenses. But the reduction in emissions would likely be offset by increased air traffic. Air travel currently produces between 2 and 3% of global CO2 emissions.
So today we're building 737 next-generation airplanes, which we call the 737 MAX.
Randy Tinseth is vice president of marketing for Boeing Commercial Airlines. He says the 737 MAX is 14% more fuel efficient than the previous generation of 737s. But it's unclear how many of the new planes Boeing sells will be the more efficient model. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
A quick perusal of the Amazon bestseller lists takes you to number 29 before you hit this year's hot book in macroeconomic policy. It's Capital in the 21st Century by the French economist Thomas Piketty. It spent a good solid couple of weeks at number one earlier this spring, based in part on its working thesis of rising wealth inequality. That is a debate in this country as well, how it's grown over the last couple of decades and how we stack up to other countries. If you want to make those comparisons, though, you need a way to quantify inequality in the first place, which brings us to a wonky little statistic called the Gini Index, spelled G-I-N-I. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark has that story.
Not everyone has the same amount of money. Some are richer, some are poorer. That's pretty obvious. But just how much more money do the rich have? How much poorer are the poor? Those are questions that not that long ago, people didn't really know how to answer. In fact, in the early 1900s, the going theory was that in any country at any point in history,
wealth distribution was constant.
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 Professor Jean-Guy Prévost studies the history of statistics at the University of Quebec, and he says a century ago, before there were many wealth or income statistics available to study, most economists thought the proportion of what the haves have compared to the have-nots was always the same in any society.
Everywhere, at all time, the top 20% have 80% of the wealth.
And the bottom 80% split the rest. This, economists argued at the time, was the natural order of things.
You could not change that.
Until 1914, when an Italian statistician named Corrado Gini came along. And this guy, Gini, said, wait, the idea of wealth distribution being always the same? That's crazy. Though, being a statistician, he said this in a 35-page paper involving lots of mathematical formulas.
K equals 1 to N, and then it goes on with a lot of equations.
He analyzed data about the size of farms in England compared to Germany, the size of inheritances in Denmark versus France, and in the process, he created what we now call the Gini Index, basically a scale from 0 to 100 that allows you to compare just how concentrated income or wealth is in a given country at a given time. So in a perfectly unequal country, a country where
one person has all the wealth,
that country would rank as a 100. On the other end of the Gini scale, in a country where everyone has exactly the same amount of money and
all the wealth is divided equally,
that country would rank a 0 on the Gini index. Of course, in the real world, countries fall somewhere in between. Sweden, which is pretty equal, is about a 23 on the Gini index. Here in the U.S., we've gone from the low 40s to the high 40s in the last decade. And then there's South Africa,
which is most unequal country in the world.
Its Gini number is in the 60s. When Gini invented the index at the beginning of the 20th century, many countries around the world, including the U.S., were headed into an era of rising equality, a growing middle class. Today, of course, we seem headed in reverse, which has made the Gini index a central measurement for everyone from the Wall Street occupiers to President Obama. But in case you're thinking the guy behind this inequality measurement was some kind of liberal softy, well, I'll let Jean-Guy Prévost break the news.
He was a member of the fascist party.
Yes, that fascist party, the one known for embracing racial supremacy, totalitarianism, and jackboots. Gini wasn't just a member, he helped build and defend the ideology.
Yeah, he was very fascist. He was even more fascist than the fascist party at the moment.
Giovanni Favaro is an economic historian at Ca' Foscari University in Venice. He says for Gini and the fascist party he belonged to, measuring inequality wasn't important because they cared so much about the poor, but because they cared about maintaining the proper balance between rich and poor. They thought if a country got too equal,
you lose the social differences, you have people who are not used to have wealth, using their wealth in bad ways and things like that.
But if a country got too unequal, Gini worried that could be bad for society too, according to Jean-Guy Prévost. Because if kids from wealthy families started inheriting too much money, they'd get lazy.
And they would kind of make a retreat from the productive sector and became people who live on their interest only, and so lose their function as a ruling class.
Even though Corrado Gini was a fascist, once he let his Gini index out of the bottle, so to speak, it became a tool that transcended fascist ideology or any ideology at all. What made Gini's work so important and still relevant 100 years later is that by having a way to measure inequality, you could start asking all these new questions from all different points of view about the way a society's wealth is distributed.
Just having that measure
changes the conversation.
Andrew Berg is an economist at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund.
There's a set of political or ethical or moral questions. You might ask whether we care about the ratio between the rich and the poor, for example, about how inequality matters for things like well-being. Or you might ask, is the crime rate higher in unequal countries? Do unequal countries grow faster?
Questions that have since been asked by people across the ideological spectrum, from radical lefties to CEOs of big corporations. And if you want to find the most comprehensive list of Gini numbers for countries around the world, it's on the website of the CIA. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
We've got this series we do. It's called I've Always Wondered, where you all ask questions about business and the economy, and we have our reporters answer them. As you might imagine, we get all kinds of questions about all kinds of things, not all of which can fit on I've Always Wondered. So today, we're going to do a little cross-purposing, I think you might say. Carol Niaga from Montreal, Canada, wrote to us a while back wanting to know who came up with rollerblades. And we figured that's a perfect thing to tackle for our stories this week called Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Rollerblades. Really is less a story about invention as much as it is a story about innovation. It's a story that begins with a guy named Scott Olson. Scott, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
We should say probably right up at the front that you're not the guy who invented inline skates, right? You took them and made them into this thing we call rollerblades.
That's my claim to fame. Right here in Minneapolis, I got started. But yeah, you're correct, Kai. The inline skate started back before roller skates were even invented.
Tell me the creation story then. What happened? How did this come to pass?
Oh, it's a great story. I used to dream of being able to ice skate wherever I could go. And I actually was up in Canada playing hockey right out of high school because my goal was to become a hockey NHL goalie.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw these skates advertised in the back of Hockey News, and I thought, wow, that'd be kind of cool. And I came home after one season up in Canada. My brother, younger brother, came skating down the street on a pair that he just got. So I raced down to the local sporting goods shop and bought a pair. And first day I put them on, I'm realizing, man, I'm doing this, and it's 80 degrees out, and I'm going anywhere. This thing's going to be a hit. So I went down to the store, bought up their remaining inventory that they hadn't sold. They only had about five at the time, and they'd been sitting on them for about 5 years. Yeah. And became a distributor of the product that was actually being made out in L.A.
And then you went out and bought the patent, right? Isn't that the deal? You bought the patent for these things?
Yeah. The guy that was marketing them and selling them out of L.A. had never been on the product, and I was always skating on them and making them faster, and eventually got a patent, got into business for myself, and then got into manufacturing them myself, and marketing them was a key, like in any product. But yeah, that's kind of the short story on it.
We should point out here that you lost the company eventually, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My main man embezzled a bunch of money from me, and that's what kind of put me behind the eight ball. But luckily, I was able to hang on and keep it moving and got some new partners, and then eventually sold out of the rollerblade company and then moved on and started other skate companies that I brought to the marketplace.
Did these things set you up financially for life? I mean, do you have to work now?
Well, yeah, I got lucky, and even though I lost the company back just when it was starting out, climbing, I think I got out when it was about $10 million, and then I had to fight a long time in the court system to get what I had signed for with this guy that took over the company. So I was able to walk away with enough money to do whatever I want in terms of living and inventing. And so, yeah, I've been very lucky to be living the dream.
You started this company, what, 30-something years ago, right? You're 55-ish now, and you were 25-something back then, right?
Yeah, well, it was 19 when I got it going, so
wow.
Yeah.
So here's the what-if question. What do you suppose you'd be doing now if you hadn't seen this guy going by on the rollerblades and said, I'm going to do that?
Oh, well, probably a taxidermist. I was always into putting animals on the wall, so I'd probably be doing that.
I have to tell you, of all the answers you could have given to that question, taxidermy was not the one I had in mind.
Yeah, well, that was a good occupation because I could do it in my own home and my own time, and, yep. And that's why I'm one of the highlights of being in business for yourself.
No, I bet. I bet the life of the successful entrepreneur. Do you still know when you see somebody rollerblading there in downtown in the Twin Cities or something, or if you come out to L.A. to the beach and you see somebody on a pair of rollerblades, you get a little thing in your heart that goes, hey, that's I did those. That's me.
I used to, not so much. It's been a while now. I don't like to live in the past, yeah. So I'm always thinking ahead. But, you know, every once in a while people will remind me or they'll introduce me as the guy that invented rollerblades, and it is a nice feeling to know that I had a part in making that thing a huge success.
Scott Olson and the rollerblades. Scott, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, enjoyed it. Thank you for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we learn once again that stock markets are stupid. Ticker symbol CRMB today up more than 1,000%, 1,197.1% exactly, which is interesting since we learned yesterday that Crumb's Bake Shop, CRMB, the cupcake chain, has shut everything down and will likely go out of business. Apparently, some guy said on CNBC this morning that he would save it, that is, throw some money at it, try to bring it back, hence the spike, which, we should be clear, took Crumb's shares to the lofty heights of about 40 cents apiece, which really is what cupcakes ought to cost, man. Come on. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hearst, George Judson, Dave Schott, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm right about the cupcakes, by the way. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.